Notes from America is supported by Future Hindsight, an award-winning podcast that shares big ideas about participating in American democracy, beyond voting, but short of running for office. Join host Mila Atmos for stimulating and incisive conversations with citizen changemakers on topics ranging from gerrymandering, policing equity, and voting rights. In this election year, Future Hindsight offers an unaffiliated perspective into what's at stake and how citizens can make an impact at the local, state, and national level. You'll always come away with something hopeful. Tune in every Thursday to get engaged and stay engaged.
Listener supported, WNYC Studios.
This is the United States of Anxiety, a show about the unfinished business of our history and its grip on our future.
I always thought to myself a significant fear that one day we too would be marching for Asian Pacific Islander lives.
Every attack I see, I think about my mother, my grandmother, my father.
To want to tune out any parts of history that don't have precisely to do with us, I feel, is a very understandable thing from an emotional perspective, but it's an incredibly dangerous thing.
What do we want it?
Overnight, this country was swept up by suspicion and fear and naked, outright hatred. We had nothing to do with Pearl Harbor.
I think the Asian American community has united in a way behind this that I've never seen before.
So now to come here and not be able to trust the government and the police that are mishandling this situation is so overall traumatizing.
Welcome to the show. I'm Kai Wright. We now know all of their names. Delana Ashley Yun, Paul Andre Michelle, Cao Jie Tan, Soon Chung Park, Hyun Jung Grant, Soon Cha Kim, Daoyo Feng, and Young A. Yu. Eight people killed in and around Atlanta in yet another act of white violence. Seven of the victims were women, and six of them were Korean and Chinese Americans. I've had a lot of conversations about this violence over the past week, and I'm stuck on a couple of themes that just keep coming up. The first is just how depressingly predictable the whole thing was, in part because we've all become so accustomed to breaking news about men with guns killing strangers they don't like for all kinds of reasons. But also because for more than a year, Asian Americans all over the country have been saying, hey, we don't feel safe. There's a problem here. Pay attention. Which leads me to the second theme that I keep coming upon. So many people can't seem to wrap their heads around this particular brand of American racism. Yes, it's easy and appropriate to drag the police deputy in Cherokee County who blamed the violence on the shooter's, quote, bad day. But if we are honest, a whole lot more people, including people who consider themselves more woke than the next, have struggled to hear the Asian American community. That's been true for a long time. And it's owing to all kinds of confusion and complexity around where Asian Americans sit in this country's maddening racial caste system. We're going to try to untangle some of this, at least, on this week's show. And we're going to start with history. I'm joined first by Helen Zia. She's an activist, former journalist, and author of a few histories of the Asian American experience. Her award-winning book, Asian American Dreams, The Emergence of an American People, detailed the development of Asian Americans, which the fastest growing population in the United States, by the way, as a self-identified racial group. She's been among those who have been ringing alarm bells about anti-Asian violence over the past year and for much longer than that, actually. Helen, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me, Kai.
You wrote an op-ed in the Washington Post last April, almost a year ago now, that said this moment was coming. You said it felt a lot like the early 1980s. Can you take us back to that time, the early 1980s? What was it about that that was similar to now?
In the 1980s, actually that story begins in the 1970s because America was in a series of economic crises. They were oil crises where there was an oil embargo against the United States and gas prices and oil prices just shot up. People couldn't afford to drive their cars anymore. They're American-made dinosaur cars that got maybe 7 or 8 or 9 miles a gallon. hard to imagine today, but, you know, gas was so plentiful and cheap that those cars were, you know, adding to the fossil fuel crisis. And so then when people couldn't afford to drive them anymore, the whole manufacturing sector of America tanked. We were in a recession throughout the country and a severe depression in the Midwest. I was in Detroit then. I had been an auto worker myself and got laid off during that crisis. And people were suffering. These were, you know, very steady jobs, high-paying blue-collar jobs that people wanted to have. And when the auto industry collapsed, people who had, you know, 30 or more years of work, you know, in this industry suddenly had no future at all. Mm-hmm. Not just them, but their kids who they had hoped to get into that industry as well. And so what we had was a country that was suffering, a region that was suffering. And initially, people were pointing fingers, you know, the UAW, the workers blamed the companies blamed the workers, and it just went on and on until there was a kind of an aha moment. Let's blame Japan. Japan is at fault for America's problems because they could make fuel-efficient cars, and therefore Japan was the enemy. There was, you know, it was like an echo chamber across the country where there was so much hatred that was spewed. Let's send another atomic bomb against Japan. Let's, you know, get the enemy. Let's eliminate the enemy. And what do you do when there's an enemy and an existential threat? You kill them. And that was repeated over and over again about Japan. And then anybody who looked Japanese had a target on their heads until one day, a Chinese American named Vincent Chin was out celebrating his upcoming wedding that week, and two white auto workers saw him and said, "It's because of you mother effs that we're out of work." A fight ensued, and the two white auto workers stalked him through the streets of Detroit, found him, and beat his brains into the streets. And that would have been bad enough, except that those two white auto workers were sentenced to probation for killing a Chinese American in an intense climate of hate. Yeah. And a big, you know, national civil rights movement led by Asian Americans, with Detroit as its improbable epicenter, emerged out of that, where Asian Americans came together and came together with black, white, brown, Latinx, every walk of life, every faith there is, came together to fight that injustice and about that hate crime. And if we fast forward to today, I have to say that the climate we're in today is remarkably similar to 1982 when Vincent Chin was killed.
And why is that? What is similar about it?
Well, instead of blaming Japan, now it's, you know, China is to blame for everything that's going wrong in America. And not only that, we have a pandemic. There's a, you know, we all are living in, you know, fear of catching this virus. Most of us are one degree of separation or less from somebody who has become very sick or even died. And so there's that terrible pain. And we're in an economic crisis, you know, a global crisis this time, where I haven't heard any economist actually predict very well what when the light at the end of the that tunnel might come. Mm-hmm. And so people are suffering. People are severely in, you know, in need. And so right now is a lot like the 1980s, except I have to say worse. You know, Vincent Chin was killed in the third year of that economic crisis. We're just at the beginning of this one. Mm. And as you said in your lead-in, many of us looked at what happened, not only to Vincent Chin, but really throughout the whole history of Asians in America, where we have been the scapegoat for almost every economic crisis. And there have been massacres and lynchings and mass killings and injustices where nobody was ever punished for those things. And then in the 1980s, we saw it again. And here we are. So as you pointed out, a year ago, many of us were looking at this today and saying, it's going to get worse. And some of us even voiced that what happened at Atlanta could happen. And so here we are at our worst nightmare.
Yeah. I also said in my opening that I've had a lot of conversations with well-meaning people who have struggled to understand this. That's another pattern I gather. People across the spectrum struggled to even hear that Asian Americans were at risk at that moment.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, the other part about being Asian in America is being, you know, like the invisible people. You know, we're kind of trotted out when it's convenient, trotted out to be scapegoated and blamed, or to be accused of being the, foreign invader, the perpetual alien, or to be the interloper and the wedge to attack other people of color, to be used against Black people. And that's something, you know, the quote, you know, model minority racist myth that exists that says, well, you know, why complain about race? Look at Asian Americans, they're doing so well, when in fact that's not even true. So those kind of falsehoods about who Asian Americans are come out when it's convenient, and the rest of the time it's that we're invisible. So it's hard for people to wrap their heads around the fact that Asian Americans have been experiencing racism from time immemorial on this continent. And that's part of the systemic racism of America when we when we talk about, you know, systems that of oppression that need to change. Asian Americans fit into that, but because we've been rendered so invisible, even our allies, even fellow progressives, you know, sometimes they're shocked and it's like, oh, you experience racism, or now you know what racism is like, and all we can do is look and say, no, we know what it's like. You know, Atlanta is a wake-up call, not so much for Asian Americans, but really a wake-up call for the rest of America.
I'm going to ask you about some of the history, some of the longer history you talked about. But first, we do need to spend a minute on the tension between Black and Asian communities that you raised. It's flared up in particular in the Bay Area, it seems like, in this past year, because some of the assailants are reportedly Black men. How do you think about this dynamic? There is a very real and present anti-Black sentiment in some Asian communities and vice versa that feels like it's showing up in this moment. How do you think about this?
Well, I'm it's not surprising. It has, you know, the friction between people who are at the bottom of the scales. You know, I just look at what's happening now and the attention that it got even before Atlanta, you know, as part of people who are the most vulnerable in society attacking each other. And because they are in pain, because they're not getting the real resources and needs, you know, met by, you know, our government, what do? They lash out at each other. And that is where I put the anti-Blackness in the Asian American community, as well as the anti-Asianness in the Black community. And and I have to say, it has not always been that way. And so this, you know, this past election cycle and even before then, there's been so much talk about the divisiveness that America has become. But part of that includes pitting people against each other. And as I was saying earlier, that's part of the role that Asian Americans have been relegated to. And this idea that Asian Americans are doing so much better than Black Americans is something that is, you know, it's complicated. There's a lot to say about that, but there's a lot of poverty in Asian American communities. In New York City, Asian Americans have among the highest poverty rate. And so what you have are people in great need who are then fighting each other. And what happens in systems of oppression is if you can get the people to fight each other and be divided, they're not going to be able to unite, not going to be able to come together and fight for their common needs. And I think in the big picture, that's what's going on. And on the ground, it's that there is so much lack of information about each other, so much ignorance within the Asian community about, you know, the civil rights and the history of what Black people have gone through. And within the Black community, there's not a lot of knowledge about Asian Americans. Actually, within all America, there's not a lot of, you know, I call it missing in history, or MIH.
Yeah, I mean, there's an enormous amount of history that I have only recently learned myself, some from reading your work. We don't have a ton of time, but I want to walk through some of it. I mean, in particular, the data that's emerged about the anti-Asian harassment and attacks now from the Stop AAPI Hate Coalition, it suggests that it's a disproportionate number have been targeted women. And certainly that's what we saw in Atlanta. There's a history there, too, about the overlap between misogyny and anti-Asian ideas. Can you talk us about some of that history?
Well, certainly. I mean, you know, just watching the sheriffs in Atlanta say, well, it can't be related to racism because, you know, it was women being attacked and sex addiction and all that stuff, as though one can separate out gender and race and other, you know, things that make us human. And one of the ways that racism works against any group includes the sexualization of women. And for Asian American women, what that means is being both seen as this exotic, you know, sexual object, as well as being passive and submissive. And in many ways, that makes Asian Americans a prime target for predators, because the racist and misogynistic view of Asian Americans is to be a you know, prime victim, not fighting back and desirable. And so, as you pointed out, the Stop AAPI Hate has recorded 2-to-1 that the people being attacked in these self-reported hate incidents and hate crimes are women. And that goes back to the thing about people who are vulnerable, who are seen as vulnerable, Asian American women, Asian American seniors and elders, Asian American children are being specifically targeted. I mean, children who are being harassed by adults. And so a lot of Asian American parents and families are really terrified of what's going to happen when schools open up and their kids, you know, have to get to school and then be in school. But as you were saying, the way Asian American women are viewed is part of a whole, you know, racial construction that includes gender.
What about the Chinese Exclusion Act? Can you just give, because again, of the things that we don't know, we could fill this whole hour with, but this is one in particular piece of history that that seems to have, that I'm noticing a lot of people don't know that as this story has unfolded. Can you just give us a quick primer on what the Chinese Exclusion Act was?
Oh, sure. The Chinese Exclusion Act, 1882, was sort of the culmination or of a federal barring of Chinese immigrants to ever become, first of all, to come here to the North America to begin with, but then to ever become citizens. And I say it's the culmination because there was a whole period of ethnic cleansing, of trying to eliminate first Chinese, but then that was extended to every people from Asia anywhere in America. But that included, you know, there were Chinatowns. If you can imagine, the state of Idaho at one point had more Chinese than any other race or ethnicity. And what happened to them? Well, they were eliminated. Many were killed. Many were chased out. It was part of the great driving out, it's called, of Chinese from America. And that was locked into law. And by the way, Asian American, Chinese American women were the first ones targeted who were to be not permitted into America, but that was followed up by the Chinese Exclusion Act, which was then repeated, renewed over time, and then included anybody from Japan, anybody from India, anybody from the Philippines, and so forth, until it became anybody from Asia. And what that meant was from those times on into the 20th century, people from Asia could not become naturalized citizens. If they could not become citizens, they could not vote. They could not run for office. They could not participate in this democracy. And so when people say, oh, you know, those Asian people, culturally, they don't want to get involved, that's just so not true. Right. It's that because of then, Asian Americans were barred from becoming involved. And what people don't know is that there were so many Asian Americans who fought against all of this. And the right to become an American by birthright was from a Chinese American, Wong Kim Ark, who fought that Chinese Exclusion Act all the way to the Supreme Court. And because of him in the 1800s, every immigrant who came from America, except from Asia, since that time, could become an American citizen by birthright. Mm. We owe that to these Asian Americans, and all of that is missing in history.
We have to leave it here, but say his name one more time, Helen.
His name is Wong Kim Ark, and every immigrant can thank him for the citizenship of their children in America.
Which means pretty much all of us. Helen Zia is an activist and author of the award-winning book, Asian American Dreams, The Emergence of an American People, among others. Her latest book, published last spring, is Last Boat Out of Shanghai, the epic story of the Chinese who fled Mao's revolution. Thanks so much, Helen.
Sure. Thank you for having me, Kai.
Coming up, we turn from the past to the present. The data on anti-Asian attacks over the past year suggests that New York City has been the undisputed epicenter. Arun Venugopal from WNYC's Race and Justice Unit will share his reporting on how this fact has landed in the community. And we will take your calls. I'm Kai Wright. This is the United States of Anxiety.
What if millions of Black Americans had been compensated for slavery? Join me, Trymaine Lee, as I explore the untold story of one of the only Black Americans who ever was. I talk to his descendants and discuss how reparations forever changed their family's trajectory and imagine a reality where reparations are paid to the rest of Black America. Into America presents Uncounted Millions, The Power of Reparations, a Black History Month series. New episodes drop Thursdays. Listen now wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back. This is the United States of Anxiety. I'm Kai Wright. We've been talking about the history of anti-Asian violence in America leading up to the horrific attack in Atlanta. And now we're going to talk about what's been happening over the past year, particularly here in New York City, which has been the epicenter of these attacks, at least according to the data that's emerging. I'm joined by Arun Venugopal from WNYC's Race and Justice Unit. Hey, Arun.
Hi, Kai.
So, Arun, I want to ask about you. I mean, you've been reporting on how Asian American communities here and around the country are dealing with this harassment and violence. I have talked on the show about the emotional toll of covering anti-Black violence, and I just wonder how you're doing right now.
Yeah, Kai. Well, thanks for asking. I mean, it is, I got to say, this week has been unlike anything in the entire pandemic. We've been through this for a year now, and I think, you know, I kind of got the impression, I was like, all right, you're in a routine, you're in a groove. It's not great, but it is what it is. And then when this happened, I guess it really kind of hit me in a way that I was not really expecting. And I think just talking to people who are Asian American, who are East Asian American, who are feeling this like the most directly, who are really, I guess, terrified, they're grieving. I don't know. It feels like this has just gone to a whole new level entirely, and it's both scary, and it's just very it's very depressing. And I think today I went to a rally. It's sunny today in New York City. It's a beautiful day. Thousands of people coming, and it was, I think, after a few days of feeling the way I've been feeling, it was kind of nice to see people coming out and to sort of re-recognize that this, what the city is like, you know, that people will come out, show up. Mm-hmm. It's sort of a moving target. I don't know what where this is headed. We are going to go back to, you know, these scary incidents. But at least for today, there was a little moment of feeling like, oh, this is what the city can be.
Yeah. And Arun, help us understand the details of the violence we've seen. So first off, as I said, New York City seems to be an epicenter, at least from the anecdotal reports. Is that what you have found as well? And if so, why?
Well, yeah, I think this is really in some ways kind of catching a lot of us off guard, because we have this sense that New York is a safe place for people of whatever background. This is a place where people come to, you know, to be among others who are like them. And the fact that a lot of these incidents of racial hatred and the sort of like the less obvious ones, the ones that kind of like you hear when you talk to enough people who are in the community, where it's sort of like the microaggressions that things don't rise to the level of, you know, where police are called, which don't necessarily arise to the level of, you know, obvious, you know, violence, but are humiliating or violent in their own way. A lot of these things are happening in Asian majority neighborhoods like Flushing, Queens, like Manhattan, Chinatown. People who are committing these acts, the understanding is that they're coming to these communities partly because they can easily find Asian Americans. That is the sense, the perception that Asian Americans themselves have, is that they're seen as easy targets, and that these acts of, you know, whether it's just humiliation or people being spat upon or being stabbed, very violent incidents, they're often happening in these places. And I think it's really, it's definitely objectively higher than it is in many cities. The number of hate incidents alone went from like 3 in 2019 to 28 last year in New York City, a very sharp increase. I think it's like 833% if you're going to measure it that way. It's much greater than what you're seeing in many other cities. A lot of people are just really worried right now. They're scared. They're not stepping out of their homes.
Yeah. I mentioned earlier that I found a lot of people have trouble taking this seriously or wrapping their head around it. We already got one caller from a white listener who we're not going to put on because we've specifically asked for Asian American listeners in this moment. But they asked, you know, is this primarily about racism, or is it really about guns and shaming of sexuality? Why do people want to jump to the race issue? So let's start with that. That's a common sentiment. Start with that in terms of how much are you hearing that, and what? How do you respond to it?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's not just happening with the people who are calling in to the show. It's happening with very prominent, you know, national pundits, commentators who are asking the same questions, and they're kind of, as they see it, I suppose, pushing back on the narrative. They think the media, some segments of the media, and I suppose Asian American community leaders themselves are jumping the gun on this. I see it personally as something that's being done in bad faith often. I think that the real question in the wake of incidents that we saw in Georgia is not simply what is in the mind of the assailant. I think that is, you know, listen, we're journalists. We know that stories have different dimensions to it. But I think really the first question is, how does this impact Asian Americans who are just feeling besieged, you know, across the country? It's a terrifying moment. And so when I see people trying to put the emphasis on that, where that's their sort of like their front foot, I definitely think you know, I think I'm just very cynical about those things. And I think it's not done in good faith.
Yeah. Well, what about those that where it is done in good faith, though? You know, I mean, I think, you know, Helen Z and I talked about some of the tensions between communities of color in particular. You know, how's there in the Black community, it can be difficult to get people to pay attention to anti-Asian violence. In the, you know, there is anti-Blackness in amongst Asians. How much have you seen here in the city, at least, any, you know, the tensions between the communities? We have a predating kind of debate here in the city because of schools and the effort to sort of change admissions policies that has led to a fight between Asian American communities and Black communities in the city as it is. So how much have you seen that come up?
Well, certainly this is something that you hear a lot. among organizers and at rallies like the one I attended today in Manhattan Chinatown, which were, you know, there must have been 3,000-4,000 people who came. It was a very well attended rally. And that was definitely one of the main points that was made over and over again, both by Asian American speakers and attendees and in the signs that there were people were holding in the crowd, as well as by African American speakers and attendees. So I think there is a real kind of grappling with this issue, is how do you both show up for victims and, you know, communities who are feeling besieged right now, as well as how do you forge the ties that are necessary to sort of like overcome these very real and substantive and thorny kind of debates, you know, whether it is with schooling, you know, access to schooling or with other areas, you know, in which the communities are kind of, you know, fighting it out. And I mean, I got to tell you, you know, Kai, I watched the other day these congressional hearings that happened that were planned before the attacks, but, you know, played out, you know, actually just 2 days after the attacks took place. And it was kind of fascinating because you had a lot of speakers who are Asian American, both congressional leaders and otherwise. And there was such a sharp divide between the Democrats, of course, who are trying to give history lessons and, you know, talk about how deeply rooted anti-Asian sentiment is in this country, you know, similar to what Helen was talking about just now on the show. And then you saw the Republican response, which, you know, beginning with the first speaker, Representative Chip Roy, but then also continuing with Asian American members of Congress who are Republicans, they were really trying to get away from the issue of the violence, and they were stressing things like access to elite colleges, access to schools, framing this as actually the real problem is that Asian Americans are being discriminated against when it comes to schooling. And so it was both striking to me in terms of how much they did not want to talk about the violence, because obviously that gets tied into language of xenophobia, but then also into this issue of the real violence is, you know, a Republican talking point. It's about affirmative action or the problem with that. And it was, I think, it was kind of dispiriting because they were completely not trying to address the problem at hand.
Let's hear from Ben. Ben, welcome to the show.
Thanks, Kai. Thanks for having me on. I just wanted to comment on your two-part, you know, question.
Please.
I mean, I actually got to give the media some credit here for finally giving some light to Asian American history. Even just your last interview, learning about Wan Kim Ark, for instance, I think that's just amazing the impact that a Chinese American has been able to provide for all of the immigrants. And, you know, as a Asian American kid growing up, you're a proud American, but I don't hear too much about my history and the impact the Asian Americans have had. So I think it's been great listening to that. And your second part, as far as any positives or anything that I've always been kind of like involved as far as the community goes, but never so much where more recently, especially last year, I've been working with my company to bring about more of inequalities and workplaces and systemic racism. And, and this is like your typical Fortune 500 marketing agency. But just to show allyship for Black Lives Matter and the horrible things that have been happening in this past year, I think that's really brought together more of a sense of community just among my peers.
Ben, can I ask you for yourself, has this past year changed anything for you in terms of your political identity around being Asian American, I guess, is the best way I can put it? Has anything shifted for you in that regard as a consequence of this?
Right. I don't think anything has changed as far as the expectations of how society views me. Unfortunately, I've always had to stand up for the fact that I am American. And I've had to explain to people why I'm American. It honestly has made me more cynical. I think it's been a horrible reckoning of where we are as a country and how much more work we have to do to really work together to become one nation, really.
Thanks for calling, Ben. I'm talking to Arun Vinogopal of WNYC's Race and Justice Unit about the recent surge in anti-Asian violence, particularly here in New York City, which has been an epicenter. And we are taking calls from our Asian American listeners. This is the United States of Anxiety. I'm Kai Wright. We'll be right back. Hey, a program note, just a reminder to always check your episode notes for our recommended companion listening for any episode. This week, go check it out for a conversation with Arun from some of his previous reporting on Asian Americans as a model minority and the violence directed to them. That's there in your show notes, and you can always find that and other recommendations every week. So check it out. I hope you'll enjoy. Welcome back. This is the United States of Anxiety. I'm Kai Wright. I'm joined by Arun Venugopal, senior reporter in WNYC's Race and Justice Unit and a general friend of the show. We've been talking about the history of anti-Asian violence in America leading up to the horrific attack in Atlanta. And Arun, I want to go back to the caller we had just before the break talked about history. And I want to bring a little bit of that back into the conversation. I'm going to play you something that historian Beth Lou Williams said to me earlier this week. I was hosting The Takeaway, another WNYC show, and I asked her why so few people know any of the history of anti-Asian violence that Helen Zia was describing. And here's what Beth Lou Williams said to me.
A lot of this violence was effective, unfortunately. It did something, you know. So when it comes to the 19th century, a lot of that violence pushed people out of communities. I study how groups expelled large numbers of Chinese immigrants out of, you know, more than 165 communities across the American West. These expulsions erased that history effectively. So this violence is tied to that that outsider status.
What do you think about that, Arun? The violence worked. It erased these communities. And I wonder about that in the current context. Can we think of this harassment and violence as having a purpose now? And if so, what is that?
Yeah, that's such a great question. I think that it certainly creates an awareness among entirely new generations of people, but it also often introduces them to people who've been sort of trying to shepherd that history, who might have been doing the work, out of view of, say, younger or less, historically informed Americans. One thing that I was thinking of when you were playing that that tape was, the last time Congress had hearings like this was in 1987, which was mentioned at the beginning of these congressional hearings a few days ago. And one thing that was brought up was not only the killing of Vincent Chin, which had happened five years earlier, but also the fact that right in that same year, 1987, there were Indian Americans who were being killed and attacked in New Jersey. There was this whole phenomenon called the Dot Busters. I think for a certain generation of Indian American, that's familiar history. But so many people in the Indian community arrived, the vast majority of the population arrived after those incidents. And so the work is challenging because you have to keep on reintroducing this stuff. And to some extent, I think part of the challenge of, say, model minority kind of framing is that you can either not really feel connected to those histories of violence and marginalization, or you just kind of discount it, you know, that's something that happened back then, you know. Mm-hmm. And I think it's part of the challenge not only of resurrecting that history, but also say, like, how does that history that affects us as, say, Indians affect, you know, how does that bring us closer to, say, Asian Americans during the pandemic, you know? Mm-hmm. And that's the work that organizers are constantly doing, is they have to keep on resurrecting the history and try to amplify it, hopefully using people who are in the community and have, say, bigger platforms, you know, nationally.
Well, in that context, you and I have talked on the show previously about the sort of shifting political consciousness among South Asians in particular. But in this moment, it seems like we're talking mostly about East Asians in terms of being targeted. And so I wonder in your reporting if you have seen any similar shifting political consciousness in any direction.
In the East Asian community?
Yeah.
I mean, right now it's so anecdotal at this point. I haven't seen anything that that you know kind of is a statistical, if you will. I think definitely there was something that someone sent me a couple days ago. It was remarks by someone who was on the cast of that show, Riverdale, which some, you know, some people might have heard of or watched, which I think is sort of like, you know, an Archie Comics come to, you know, soap opera form or whatever. And he's Asian American, and he wrote this very powerful account saying, you know, for years I distanced myself from my identity and this history because it was embarrassing to be associated with something that was made fun of. When people made fun of, you know, the smell of my home and the cuisine or certain names and, you know, that kind of thing, the language. And he realized after this that there was just no going back to that because you realize there's, you know, distancing yourself from your history only serves, you know, a certain short-term goal. The long-term is you have to address the history, you have to own it, and you have to kind of hold it up before the histories of other communities if you want to try to understand, like, where you stand in relation to one another and perhaps how you can sort of find commonality in the face of something like white supremacy.
Let's go to Muhammad on line one. Muhammad, welcome to the show.
Hello. Yes. Thank you so much for attending my call. I'm calling from Queens. I belong to Queens and New York, and originally from Pakistan, from the north, from the Himalayan mountains. So first of all, I want to thank you for media to paying attention on the Asian American identity, and also paying attention towards the history of any contribution. But I'm also very sorry what happened in Atlantic City. And I think that if we have done much of education and understanding, and we have paid attention over years, we could not have seen such horrible experience. And I see that I could be, it arises the fear of being Asian here in the world most diverse city in New York. It could be someone else, it could be me, it could be anyone else from Asia. We should not give any space for hate against any group.
Muhammad, can I ask you for yourself, as you say, being in the most diverse city in Queens, the most diverse county in the country, have you changed in any way over the past year in terms of what you're building and your connection to community as a consequence of this?
Oh, yes. Seeing a lot of seeing the rise and rise in the hate. Personally, I feel more insecure. Fortunately, I didn't experience personal attack or any stuff. But it's because we see the 100% rise in the hate crimes against Asians, so that's so much to think about and so much to pay attention at educational level and communal level and in policy level.
Thank you, Muhammad, for calling in. Let's go to Julie in Sunnyside, Queens. Julie, welcome to the show.
Hello, my name is Julie Won, and I'm a city council candidate in Sunnyside for District 26. That's Long Island City, Sunnyside, Woodside, and Astoria. And I wanted to call in about some of the heartbreaking moments that we've had as a nation, as well as what it's been like to organize the last few years throughout the last presidential cycle. Because it's definitely the rhetoric that we've seen nationally has increased the tolerance, as well as it seems like people are more brave in ways that they should not be to say a lot of hate speech and to behave in ways that are not acceptable in any shape or form when it comes to violence, not just towards Asian Americans, but towards Black and Brown folks as well.
Thank you, Julie, and good luck on your campaign. Let's go to Henry in Inglewood, New Jersey. Henry, welcome to the show.
Yeah, definitely. Thank you for my call. So I guess I have a lot to relate. But I first thank you both for actually taking the moment and reflect Asian American history. Actually, I personally hear the story of Mr. Wang, the Superior Court case from Corey Johnson. In Chinatown during a 150-year anniversary of the cross-country railroad worker who actually build and connect the cross-country railroad. I mean, in terms of the crime in Atlanta, I have two really profound feelings. Mm-hmm. After observing like U.S. politics society for about 25 years, never after a massacre, a law enforcement was trying to pardon a suspect like this time.
Yeah.
So this is really shocking, really shocking. But let me get to my question. So the question is, what can Asian American, particular Chinese American, can learn from the history and deal with the great crisis and moment, especially with the clash of titans between China and the U.S.?
Thank you, Henry. Arun, to that general question, what can we take from all of this history to move us forward?
I think. I mean, like one thing that we, as journalists, as historians, as storytellers, often emphasize is the long history of vilifying Asian Americans, right? The other flip side is that why are some Asian Americans valorized, right? And that is a relatively more recent history. We're talking about like wartime, post-war. And it has a lot to do with, you know, courting, you know, Asian countries. Both things, vilifying and courting, you know, valorizing them, they have the effect of tying Asian American lives to Asian nations. And it's all very much, it's an extractive kind of a very mercenary approach to, you know, Asian Americans, because it's using them as proxies for larger kind of geopolitical interests and all that kind of stuff. And that's what we're seeing is that, you know, both in the way that we kind of hold up Asian Americans is better than other people, say better than Black lives, mm-hmm. As well as the fact that we'll you know, this discourse around attaching what happens in China to someone who's in Chinatown here in New York City. Both of these things are deeply problematic, and we have to hold up that history to understand how Asian Americans have been sort of manipulated by nationalism and larger mm-hmm. sort of things, and take that apart.
Arun Venugopal is senior reporter in WNYC's Race and Justice Unit. He was one of the founders of this show back in 2016. Arun, thanks for coming.
Thanks, Kai.
The United States of Anxiety is a production of WNYC Studios. Joe Plourd mixed the podcast version. Kevin Bristow and Matthew Miranda were at the boards for the live show. Our team also includes Carolyn Adams, Emily Botin, Ginny Casas, Karen Frillman, and Christopher Wirth. Our theme music was written by Hannes Brown and performed by the Outer Borough Brass Band. Vera Lynn Williams is our executive producer, and I am Kai Wright. You can keep in touch with me on Twitter at Kai_Wright. And, of course, I hope you'll join us for the live show next Sunday, 6 p.m. Eastern. Stream it at WNYC.org or tell your smart speaker to play WNYC. Till then, thanks for listening. Take care of yourselves. Enjoy the spring.
Notes from America is supported by Future Hindsight, an award-winning podcast that shares big ideas about participating in American democracy, beyond voting, but short of running for office. Join host Mila Atmos for stimulating and incisive conversations with citizen changemakers on topics ranging from gerrymandering, policing equity, and voting rights. In this election year, Future Hindsight offers an unaffiliated perspective into what's at stake and how citizens can make an impact at the local, state, and national level. You'll always come away with something hopeful. Tune in every Thursday to get engaged and stay engaged.